Hi, and welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Simon Smart.
Origin stories, those accounts, mythical or otherwise, of where things come from, they tend to hold an endless fascination for us. They exist to tell us who we are, where we come from, and what our purpose is. Of course, they're not always reliable. They're sometimes, perhaps often, contested in one way or another. Maybe the most controversial or disputed origin story of all is the one that we find at the beginning of the Bible, the Judeo-Christian creation story. Few issues get a stronger reaction along the science-religion fault line than this question of the origins of life, of where everything comes from. In fact, the apparent conflict between the Bible's creation story and the theory of evolution is sometimes pegged as a reason not to take Christianity seriously at all. Today, we want to suggest that it actually isn't a very good reason, that although not all Christians have the same ideas on this, it isn't necessary to choose between the findings of science and the claims that the Bible makes about the origins of life.
Yeah, actually, if you read the opening chapters of the book of Genesis on their own terms, I love these opening chapters. Instead of reading them through the lens of specifically scientific questions, then we are able to see what's meaningful and compelling in the story, no matter how you read it. It's not an account of how everything came to be, but really important ideas like creation is a good thing. This was news to people used to other ancient creation stories, that it wasn't evil or chaotic, that it's an intentional work of a creator God, that people are important and precious, in fact, the pinnacle of God's creation, and that there's this good God behind the whole thing. These are big, profound ideas, regardless of how you read the chronology of these chapters. Now, we're going to play some of an interview we did with Oxford Professor of Mathematics John Lennox later in the program on this question of what the Genesis creation story has to tell us. But first, we have Chris Mulheron with us. He lectures and tutors in the history of science, philosophy, and theology. He's currently completing a PhD on the relationship between science and religion. He's also executive project officer at ISCAST, a Christians in Science organization. Chris recently wrote an article for The Conversation on the different categories of creationists, and he joins us by phone from Melbourne. Welcome, Chris.
G'day, Simon. How are you doing?
In the article, you talk about a confusion of causes as a common error in this debate. There are different kinds of causes, and that isn't always acknowledged in this creation-evolution discussion. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's not a new thing. It's Aristotle, 2,500 years ago, talked about the four sorts of cause and suggested that basically to understand the cause of something, you had to understand different aspects of or different types of causes. The example I used in my article, I think, was the example of the beaker of boiling water. And if you ask what's the cause of the water boiling, the physicist will give one answer, which is in terms of molecules and energy and all that sort of thing. And that would be right. But somebody else, you know, the teacher might take out a tea bag and say, well, actually, no, it's boiling because I want a cup of tea. And that would also be a correct answer. In other words, there are different sorts of causes, and unless you tease out those different sorts of causes, then you get confused. And if you think there's only one sort of cause, then you get confused as well. So it's fine for science to do its thing, but it's also fine for religious people to say, well, we believe that the ultimate cause of everything is God creating.
Chris, the picture that we often get from the media on this issue can be quite an extreme one, but your article is at pains to distinguish between different strands of Christian belief in this area and to remind us that it's not homogenous. The first strand that you discuss in your article is young earth creation or creationism. This one, you know, gets a particularly bad rap. What do you think is important to understand about this view?
Well, for a start, I think it's important to understand that the people who are promoting young earth creationism are faithful Christians who are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to be faithful to the Bible, and they're doing it in a particular way. So I personally disagree with their way of doing it. I don't think that you have to be a young earth creationist to be faithful to the Bible. So young earth creationism says, as I said, Genesis 1-3 can only be read faithfully as describing 24-hour days. So God created in six 24-hour days, rested on the seventh day, and that sort of thing, and has been associated with biblical chronologies. If you add up a certain way of reading the chronologies in Genesis and the rest of the Bible, then you get to a creation date of approximately 4004 BC. And obviously that view runs smack bang up against mainstream science. And when I say mainstream science, I'm talking about the history of science, which is full of Christians who were quite convinced they were being faithful to the Bible and also faithful to what God reveals in the world around us, the natural world around us.
So a slightly different term that gets thrown around a lot is intelligent design. How does that differ from young earth creationism?
Yeah, intelligent design's a little bit harder to get a handle on because, strictly speaking, intelligent design isn't a religious position at all, strictly speaking. I mean, the facts of the matter are that the intelligent design movement is run by Christians and it's basically a Christian view. But strictly speaking, intelligent design says, let's be really scientific about this. Science is willing to accommodate any theory that explains the facts. And when you look at the facts of particularly evolution, there are gaps, there are things that we simply can't explain, at least at this point in time. And the best explanation would be a designer.
So I think, Chris, you're not entirely satisfied with this explanation, is that right?
I'm not satisfied with it on a couple of grounds, I guess. One is, I don't think it's science. I think that it's probably better to keep science, not try to redefine what science is, but keep science as that exercise that looks for natural causes in things and natural connections. The other danger is the danger of the God of the gaps. Now, the God of the gaps is an idea that where there is a gap in knowledge, something clearly inexplicable, at least at the moment, then you can say, well, God is obviously the answer to the question that we can't answer. Now, the danger with the God of the gaps is if you say that God is obviously the answer and then next week or next year or next decade, somebody comes up with a, quote, scientific answer, a natural answer, then you've squeezed God out of the gap. So that's one problem with, that's a couple of problems with ID, which isn't to say, of course, which isn't to say that God isn't involved in evolutionary history and all the rest of it, but to be able to say that we can see exactly where is a little bit more difficult and a little bit dangerous.
Now, Chris, on that then, you write that most scientists who are Christians, and perhaps in the West at least, the majority of Christians today, hold to a different view, sometimes called theistic evolution. Can you explain that to us briefly?
Yes. Theistic evolution is a view about biological evolution, but more broadly speaking, most scientists accept mainstream science in all different realms, not just biology, most Christian scientists. So the gist of it is that they accept mainstream science on the one hand, and they accept orthodox Christian faith on the other hand, and they don't find a fundamental conflict between the two. Now, that's a very old view. Augustine warned about the dangers in just, you know, the year 400 and something or other. He warned about the dangers of Christians mouthing off about things they didn't understand. So that tradition has been around for a long, long time, and you can name a host of people who are known more for their science than anything else who are actually committed believers of one sort or another as well.
So, Chris, would it be fair to say that you really feel that creation and evolution and the way they relate shouldn't be an obstacle for people when they come to read the Bible or to consider the claims of the Christian faith?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that Christians ought to affirm as God-given gifts, if you like, our ability to understand the natural world, the world that is God's world. We ought to affirm that, and what I'm saying is we ought to embrace mainstream science, which doesn't mean everything science says is true and some things won't be overturned and that sort of thing. But in general, we ought not to have a suspicious attitude or see a sort of conspiracy in mainstream science. We ought to embrace it, and we ought to also embrace the Orthodox Christian faith and a high view of the Bible.
Well, Chris, this is a fascinating ongoing discussion. I'm sure there'll be plenty more to say about it, but it's been great to get your thoughts on it. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to talk to you.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith. We've been discussing the often controversial topic of creation and evolution, and speaking with Chris Mulheron from the University of Melbourne about the different strands of Christian belief in this area. Someone else who regularly debates this issue in high-profile public settings is John Lennox, who's professor of mathematics at Oxford and who recently spoke to Simon about the 7 days of creation, the age of the earth, and what Genesis is trying to tell us about who we are and where we come from. Here's a couple of highlights from that interview.
John, I want to talk to you about the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible. You've done a bit of thinking about this. You've got a book out on that, the 7 days that divide the world. How do you reconcile the description you find in the book of Genesis with what you know as a scientist?
Well, we start with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then there is a sequence of 6 days, and each of them begins with the phrase, and God said, and God said, and God said. And then after those 6 days of creation activity, God rests on the seventh day. Okay. Now, just looking at that, the first thing to notice is there is a literary pattern. One would logically conclude, I think, prima facie, that day one begins with, and God said. And that means that in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth is not talking about day one, but is prior to day one. Now, instantly, you see, that removes the difficulty with people saying that the Bible insists the earth is young. The Bible doesn't insist the earth is young. It says, in the beginning, God creates the heaven and the earth. It doesn't say what that time that was at. And then it gives a sequence of creative acts of God, which we can discuss separately. And interestingly enough, when you check with the Hebrew scholars, they tell you that the tense changes from verses 1 and 2 to verse 3. And the tense that's used in verse 1 and 2 is normally the tense used to describe something that happens prior to the sequence that's following. So there's corroboration from both logic and grammar that perhaps this text is a little bit more sophisticated than people think it is.
Well, let's look at Genesis itself then, and putting aside some of these arguments. What are the key messages of Genesis, early chapters of Genesis, and why do they matter?
Well, I like your question, because the sad thing is, with many people, they think that once they have come to a satisfactory for them understanding of the days of Genesis, they've understood Genesis. They haven't begun to understand Genesis. Genesis is utterly foundational to the theistic, the Judeo-Christian worldview. It tells us, first of all, that there was a beginning. It tells us that God was the beginner of everything. He is eternal. It tells us that God is not a force, he's a person. And it begins to build up a picture off the universe step by step. It tells us that God had a goal in building up the universe. His goal was to have human beings on it. And they are special. How are they special? They're made in God's image. The Bible is very careful to explain that although the heavens show the glory of God, they weren't made in his image. Human beings were. So they're the pinnacle of his creation. That immediately puts a stamp on their values. And it tells us he created them equal, male and female. That is an enormously important thing for the value of men and women in the contemporary world. We read of sin entering into the world. We read of the damage it does, the fracture between God and human beings. And because of that, we begin to understand why the way back must include where the fracture occurred. The fracture occurred because people couldn't trust God, so they have to learn to trust God again, and how that's brought about. It's those things that are vastly important. Much more important than the days of Genesis, if I might say so, because I noticed that they are not mentioned in the New Testament at all.
That was John Lennox, Professor of Mathematics at Oxford University, explaining what he sees as important and not so important in the Bible's account of the origins of life. You can watch the full interview and others with John Lennox on our website at publicchristianity.org. Thanks for joining us on Life and Faith. We'll see you next week.